refuse to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This is the program where we invite people who have something to say to take the opportunity to say it. Our program is supported by listeners. I want to single out James Hallwell of Sonoma County, California, and A. Noel Rinaldi. I'm not sure where A. Noel resides, but A. Noel is a monthly subscriber to the Peter B. Collins Show, and I appreciate your support. You can log on to peterbcollins.com. The voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. Thank you all.
Somebody I never met, but in a way I know. Didn't think that you could get so much from a picture show. Man dies first, real people ask, what's the deal? This ain't how it's supposed to be. Don't like no aboriginal.
And later in this program, we're going to talk once again with Mark Lisgard. He is the political poet from Portland, and his newest volume, based on the day's events, is called Babbling On in Babylon. And we'll share some of those rhyming lines about political events and newsmakers coming up later in this podcast. We're joined now by Nomi Prinz, who returns to our program. Her name is Nomi, N-O-M-I, like Naomi without the A, Prinz, P-R-I-N-S, and I spell it because I really want you to read her book. It's called It Takes a Pillage, subtitled Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. And we've talked to Nomi a couple of times. I almost said Naomi. We talked to Nomi a couple of times over the fall, and I finally had a chance to sit down and read the book cover to cover. Nomi, congratulations. You did an excellent job of bringing out the information that the corporate media may have offered here and there, but never put all in one place. And you color it with the analysis of your own experience as a managing director of Goldman Sachs and some other Wall Street entities that you worked for before that. Congratulations on an excellent job.
Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Well, and it's something I've recommended to all of my brothers and to a number of people who, you know, raise questions about the bailouts, about the Wall Street, and about executive compensation. And the real eye-opener is that you and Matt Taibbi, I think, are the only people that I've seen who have reported in depth and in detail about the true extent of our government's involvement in the rescue of Wall Street.
Yeah, and it's so much more substantial. And Matt is a fantastic reporter as well. And thanks for mentioning him. We've gone back and forth in our frustration over this. I think that a lot of the media really tends to focus on the bailout being a much smaller bailout than it actually was, and takes these sound bites or press releases or whatever from the banks as being gospel, and they come out all the time. You know, today, for example, Citigroup is paying back a little bit of its bailout, but the headlines are Citigroup is paying its like entire government bailout, and it's not paying its entire government bailout. But what happens is information or misinformation continues to get put forth into the public spectrum, and then you kind of forget what's really happening behind those scenes.
Well, and there's been calculated deception, and it, in some ways it pains me to say this, but President Obama, Secretary Geithner, and Fed Chairman Bernanke have minimized and obfuscated and dissembled to avoid confirming to the American people the extent of the commitments that have been made that you detail in the book that amount to current outstanding $13-plus trillion.
Right.
And they just focus on TARP. Oh, $700 billion, TARP, that's the beginning and the end of it. And it frustrates me to no end. And Nomi, here is an editorial in the San Francisco Chronicle, December 14, and says, well, the Independent Congressional Oversight Panel released an assessment of TARP, and it goes on to say, it's satisfying to learn that TARP did indeed work. Despite the withering criticism of Treasury Secretaries Hank Paulson and Timothy Geithner, it seems that they got something right. Quote, although the government's response to the crisis was at first haphazard and uncertain, it eventually proved decisive enough to stop the panic and restore market confidence. Now, what a crock of shit.
Yeah, it's really sad because a lot of that's a very common commentary right now. San Francisco Chronicle, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, in some places. It's on the one hand, there is a truism to it, but that's not stated in those commentaries, which is that it did work for certain banks. It absolutely did, but it did none of the things it was supposed to do. And if it restored confidence, it restored capital to the banks. It allowed them, when they were in a period of time last year where they were unable to borrow from each other, where there was no trust between the various banks on Wall Street, that the government came in and said, hey, you don't trust each other, so we'll just float you. We'll just give you money in a myriad of ways, not just the $700 billion TARP program. That happens to be the only program that was congressionally approved.
Yes.
The rest of the 13 or so trillion. And what I do, just to break, Peter, is I keep on a monthly basis, just because otherwise it would drive me crazy to continue to see these types of headlines and commentaries, a report, and I update it, of what has been extended to the banking sector from the Fed, the Reserve, from the Treasury Department, extraneous through the FDIC, and congressionally approved, and when it was extended, what the amount was, which entity extended it, and if the extension is taken away, I also reduce it. I mean, I'm not on one side here. I'm actually mm-hmm. trying to get to the real number, and it does change on a monthly basis. It doesn't tend to change in the media, so it doesn't seem like anybody else is really keeping track of how this number changes, which is how you can say things like, well, TARP worked. One of the ways in which it did work, however, is it gave the banks, again, that money that they would not have otherwise had, and what they did with it is none of the things that were promised to be done with the TARP money when Congress voted on it and when former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson freaked out the nation, I suppose, and certainly many Congress people who are also looking at either re-election or other types of their own personal issues to extend the money. But it did not extend credit to individuals. It did not extend credit to small businesses. It did not increase lending. It did not make it easier to renegotiate mortgages. It did not make it easier to renegotiate any type of credit extension to individuals or small businesses. In fact, all of that went precisely the opposite way. So if you look at what's happened in the last year, banks got a pile of money.
Yeah.
And banks are posting profits out of that pile of money. Why? Because if you give anyone enough money, they're going to look like they're doing well with it. But the way in which they're doing well is really the thing that needs to be inspected, because they're not doing well on consumer businesses. Those continue to bleed money. They are in a worse state this year than they were last year. Where they are doing well is in their trading businesses. Where they're doing well is in their speculative activities, and speculative from a variety of different way speculative, not just from we bet, you know, the market's going to go up today and it went up. Not that kind of speculation. But, you know, for example, there's a trillion dollars of a thing called an SPE, a special purpose entity, which basically means a place off of Citigroup's book. And Citigroup was one of the biggest recipients on the bank side of, mm-hmm. of federal aid in a lot of different manners. Just $1 trillion worth. And why is it $1 trillion worth? Because Citigroup says it is. A, that's a ridiculous amount of whatever to be off of their books. B, they're the ones who are evaluating it and giving the feds and the SEC and whomever a number as to what it's worth. That is no different from what was happening before the crisis. So the thing is, they can evaluate things high. They can trade off capital the government has given them. They are producing profits off of the back of that in trading-related ways. They are not doing any of the things related to the public they were supposed to have been doing. No.
And a year later, it has not trickled down. And no. We saw President Obama say, well, we got this money back. into the TARP fund because Bank of America and others have repaid the money that we advanced them. And so now we're going to push that out to small business and for mortgage relief and for some of the things that you ticked off, which were the original intent of the Pelosi-Bush bailout package, the TARP package, that have yet to be achieved.
Right, exactly. And if you just think about how ridiculous that is for a second, we are, but not only has it not been achieved, the fact that Obama or anybody in Washington would be pleased with the fact that TARP has, quote, worked, and now we get to use that money to do what we were supposed to do to begin with, i.e. give it to, say, small businesses, one of the aspects, is like, yeah, wait a minute, you are acting like a bank. Okay, you just gave money to all these banks. They said, thanks, we're not going to use it to anything we said we were going to use it. We're going to use it to make our own profits and to speculate and to post numbers on our balance sheets that you can't possibly verify anyway, but that's what we're going to do. And in the meantime, the U.S. government is like, all right, well, now we got to figure out a way to give this money to small businesses because the banks didn't do it. As opposed to saying, you guys, wait a minute, we're not going to step in and be the bank to these businesses unless we close you down, in which case we have a nationalized banking system, which is not what we're talking about. But the very notion that the government should now step in, and that's somehow a good thing, that's somehow linked as, okay, well, TARP worked, we have the money back, now we get to use it for what we're going to use it for to begin with, is like, you know, you just want to kind of bop him on the head and say, are you listening to yourself?
Well, and the trick, even with what Obama recently said, is that one of the stipulations of TARP is that money will have to be passed out through the banks. It can't come to any third parties or, you know, non-financial institutions. It's once again, at least part of it's going to be peeled off by the very people who created the wreckage that we are paying for. Now, Nomi, I'd like to get your reaction to some of the elements of the Barney Frank proposal that is working through his committee in the House right now. And some of it on paper starts to address the problems, but it seems to me very watered down as a starting point, and that it really doesn't address, as you point out in your book, some of the fundamental issues that really need to be fixed or addressed if we're going to prevent what you refer to as the second great bank depression, and I'll ask you to describe that terminology in a moment. But on the consumer protection side, they want to consolidate authority for protecting consumers into one agency, and this one super agency would enforce rules on credit cards, mortgages, loans, retailers and auto dealers would be exempt from the oversight. Is this a meaningful proposal in your view?
It's a meaningful start, I think. I think the whole notion of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is positive. I mean, it's really replacing or attempting to replace, I should say, all the failures of the Federal Reserve, who did zero to protect consumers from awful banking products or from banks leveraging those products into a million different things and making so much money off of them. So given that the Fed did nothing, having a Consumer Financial Protection Agency who could do anything would be an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem's going to come into play with, first of all, it's going to get watered down big time by the Senate because there's just so much more fighting and so much more at stake between the lobbyists and the banks and the senators and re-election and everything else. So a lot of it's even the Frank format's going to be watered down. But mm-hmm. the issue of just focusing on the products, which is important, the consumer-related product is useful. It will give consumers a place to appeal and all that kind of thing when things are bad, and it will go through language and it will create a tie-up and everything. And some of that might be positive, some of that might be preventative, but it doesn't really have the power to enforce actions to, in as far as I understand current language, and I think it will, again, get watered down. Like, for example, if an investment bank or a bank creates a toxic asset or what becomes a toxic asset off of the back of subprime loans, there's a couple problems there. The subprime loans might themselves have been opaque and given wrong, and mm-hmm. the borrower might not have understood the risk that they were undertaking and everything else, and that is a problem that the Consumer Financial Protection Agency might and should be able to address. But when it comes into a situation where, okay, well, now that subprime loan has been packaged into another asset, and that asset has been packaged into another asset, and so on and so forth, to what became assets with 10 or 20 different levels of repackaging. You're talking, it's, you know, it's Christmas time, holiday time. It's like regifting something 20 different times. Something gets lost in that, in that whole give. But the agency doesn't necessarily have the power to do anything about that whole chain over the initial loan. And so on the one hand, it's good to have an additional watchdog on the loan because no one in Washington was doing their job to do that to begin with. On the other hand, not being able to really be enforcing the whole chain is going to diminish the potential power an extra agency could have.
Next item here, I have real problems with preserve the federal government's ability to preempt tougher state consumer protection laws under certain circumstances. Now, this issue came into focus a few years ago when Jackie Speier, who is now a member of Congress, was a senator in the California legislature, and three different times she passed laws that would protect consumers from, say, having Bank of America, where I have some money, sell my information or give my information to an entity like Countrywide, which is now part of Bank of America, or even to a party that barely has any connection to Bank of America. And after she took three runs and finally got the governor to sign it, they then preempted it at the congressional level and just gutted that bill so that the enhanced consumer protections for Californians would be watered down to the level of the weakest state regulations.
Right.
So is there a bright side to this? Is there a good reason to have federal preemption?
No. There is no good reason, and I think that was that was just a give to the banking sector, because for the most part, certainly the most powerful banks are a culmination of many mergers across many state lines. And so what they don't want to have to do is sit there and deal with, like, state regulators and state attorney generals and whatever it might be, telling them what to do in any one given place when they are a national entity, a federal entity, and they just don't want to be bothered. So that give was very much a strong lobby from the banking sector saying, all right, we actually know that we will get away with more under the federal government's jurisdiction and watch than we could possibly under certain state attorney generals or other types of watching. So given that they were afraid of what could happen on the state level, they know, and unfortunately we do too, that on the federal level there's just less oversight, there's just much more wiggle room, and so that was the reason for that. So there's no positive outcome of that for individuals or for systemic risk, because again, the federal government has not done a very good job, as we saw last year, of containing risk. The fact that they're now patting themselves on the back because TARP is working is just so not understanding the banking industry that it's just frustrating. But that is why the federal versus state exemption fight was actually lost by individuals or by the citizens, and it was won by the banks.
All right, here's another element of the Barney Frank proposal. Allow consumers to sue credit rating agencies for flawed evaluations of financial products. What is the current state of law there, and why haven't these rating agencies been sued for the way they propped up assets that they knew to be bad?
Yeah, well, the current state is they actually, even though they sort of have to report as public companies into the SEC what they do, they actually have a level of separation from the thing that they're rating and the fact that they're a rating agency, so that they don't have currently a culpability on anything that happens to the asset, which doesn't make sense to begin with, of course. These rating agencies were a part of the problem in a lot of different ways, not least the fact that they were paid by the same investment banks that were creating the assets that imploded the system. And not a little amount of assets, $14 trillion worth of assets were created between 2002 and 2007 before things started sort of falling apart. And during that time, banks were making fees, of course, on the creation of the assets. And rating agencies get paid on the basis of size and frequency. So, for example, they get paid on having big, many deals. And the bigger the deal, The bigger the asset that's created that they then rate, the more fees that they get because it's a percentage. So there's and the flip side of that is the bank, by getting their stamp of approval, by getting a AAA or a really high mark of approval from a rating agency, can sell more of an asset. So because a bank can sell more, they can create more. So then the rating helps the bank sell, and because then it's a larger size asset, the rating agency also gets money out of the sheer size percentage. So
isn't that sweet?
It's a very, you know, it's a very, you know, you scratch my back kind of situation. So what this amendment is just trying to say is that, well, that's all fine. We're not going to touch that relationship. That can stay in place. They still can get paid on size. However, if they do screw up on a particular asset, and there are, you know, people who notice, you know, whether it's a class action or whether it's individuals or whoever, they do now have a responsibility or accountability link to the asset. So on the one hand, it's actually a positive on that hand. On the other hand, of course, they can still, they still make money off of size and frequency. So that relationship is the same. A better way to have done that whole rating agency containment would have been to, you know, not have them get paid by size and by volume, and have them actually be independent from the deal completely.
Mm-hmm.
And be an objective evaluator. And that would actually entail them being actually slightly nationalized, which wasn't brought up, which isn't going to happen. But
yeah. Well, it seems to me, I don't have a precise proposal, but we need to separate those who rate investments from the people who create and sell them, and there cannot be this obvious conflict of interest.
Right.
And whether the ratings agencies need to be bonded or they have to be subject to inspections or reviews to make sure that they are independent and objective. We need to find some mechanism to fix that, because as it stands, these ratings are truly meaningless.
No, they are. I mean, it'd be like having, you know, an Airbus maker or something try to get out of having an FAA. Basically trying to buy an FAA approval.
Yeah.
We wouldn't want to fly that plane. And then, you know, and as it stands, not be sued if something happens to the plane. Now they can get sued, but they still, you know, can sort of have a way of getting the FAA to sort of do what they want,
mm-hmm.
which is what the current situation is with the rating agencies and the banks. I mean, I just think it should be independent. I agree with you. I think it should be independent. I think it should be more of a national agency like we have for food, like we have for airlines. You know, just this is a financial danger instead of a health danger, but it's still a danger. So,
well, after what I learned about the USDA and the FDA after the last Mad Cow episode, I think the FAA is the best example, because you know, we had a financial crash that was, you know, and the aircraft was certified as safe by the inspectors, the bond rating agencies. And there were no contraindications that came from the Securities and Exchange Commission or any other alleged independent authority.
Right. Which is sort of, and that's a danger. I mean, that is a more significant crash than a financial crash, of course. But
yes.
This is the financial version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still ongoing. That conflicted relationship was not hampered by anything.
Mm-hmm. All right. the next.
Know, so that's part of the problem. So again, it was a decent thought, and it was something that needed to be done. You know, mm-hmm. minimally, to have rating agencies have accountability towards what they've done. But it did fall short of making them independent from the conflict of interest they have, which is. And the other thing, just separately on rating agencies, you know, it's also the information that they have, the reports that they do, you know, that they give to the banks that also pay them for those. You know, there's a whole other relationship there. They're not really always publicly available. So a lot of the information that they do get on publicly traded assets, or sometimes on private assets that might impact the public if they go wrong, because everything mm-hmm. is so interconnected. you know, they don't sort of give out. So they're also a very private entity in terms of the research about these assets as well as how they rate them.
Mm-hmm. All right, the next area of the Frank proposal regards executive compensation. They want to give shareholders the right to vote on comp and golden parachute packages and require that independent directors sit on compensation committees. If that's meaningful, if we really did have outside directors, and if we really enforce the fiduciary rules that require them to honor the rights of shareholders over their cronies in management, this might get us somewhere. But I'm really dubious, Nomi. I don't think there will be any meaningful regulation of executive compensation.
No, there won't. And, you know, we're sitting here being very negative about all this, and it's true. There's just you have to look at this stuff cynically. On the one hand, I don't think merely capping or restricting compensation gets to the core problem of compensation, which is that these companies take a lot of risk in order to pay the exorbitant percentages of compensation out of their total profits that they pay. I mean, Wall Street firms pay 50% or so of their profits in compensation costs, and that figure is more like 20 to 25% in other large corporations that are non-financial. So there's a lot of sort of flush around there that gets paid out rather than retained by the company or given to the shareholders. Now, that said, shareholders don't seem to mind some of this because they continue to buy, you know, like Goldman Sachs stock is up significantly. They've had significant profits this year, a lot of that on the back of government subsidies and government capital, but they're on track for record bonuses. Now, if I were on the board, if I were running the firm, actually, I just written a piece about the bonus situation at Goldman because they came out with some like funny way of rejiggering it, which meant nothing last week. And someone from Goldman, actually, a former partner, emailed me and said, you know, why are you picking on Goldman? And I said, well, you know, because they deserve that. But also, in terms of compensation, this person was like, well, what would you do if you were running the firm in terms of compensation or if you were the government looking at compensation? I said, well, first of all, if I was running the firm, I would be embarrassed. I would be mortally humiliated to even announce the fact that we're getting record bonuses this year. I would just not let that happen. I don't even care what the profits were. I would just out of sheer, I don't know, perspective, not do that and not acknowledge how much government assistance I received in order to get to a position where bonuses were so high.
Well, now, clearly, Nomi, you are not a reptile.
Well, no. I added to that that this is why I would never be the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
And you probably haven't been invited to their holiday parties this year.
No, the last holiday party I wrote about in my first book, that was in 2001. That was the last one I was invited to. But and it was a great large party. They spent a lot on it. But but the thing with government regulating of compensation, and there has been a lot of haphazard little minor things like the Tazar, Kenneth Feinberg is going around capping a couple of salaries at a couple of firms that still owe TARP money and that kind of thing, which is why all the banks are struggling to pay back TARP right now to pay their bonuses. And all that really doesn't help change the culture of risk. It certainly doesn't change greed, but leave that aside. It doesn't change the risk that these banks are taking in order to be able to pay the bonuses they're making.
Well, we have this fundamental problem that bonuses are paid whether the company makes money or not. And I'm much more comfortable with massive bonuses when there was a huge profit that year and when shareholders appropriately benefited from that. But when we see dividends aren't being paid, but exec comp and bonuses are, and the company, you know, was in the red for that year,
right.
Well, this is seriously out of whack.
Right, and it's worse. Well, A, they're in the red for a year, then they get government funding. I don't mind if banks want to deal with their shareholders in their own way and run the risk of shareholders running. If shareholders won't run and will stick in for whatever their reasons are, that's one thing. But when you start to open it up to public subsidies, that's when those things just don't apply. So if you have a situation like last year where, here's the thing, the top five banks in the country last year totaled a trading loss of $608 million. So basically they were a little negative. That popped up to $119 $6 billion annualized for this year. So basically, they've made, you know, $120 billion somewhere between this year and last year on paper anyway. And out of that, they're paying. But the fact is, we've given them trillions of dollars on which to make up this money. So it's like if you give someone trillions of dollars and they make, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, that's actually not a very good business model anyway. So then you go and, like, you pay bonuses that are record off the back of this, or you have these, like, petulant, you know, and I worked with some of these, you know, people who are like, oh, if you don't pay me $50 million, then I'm going to quit. If you don't pay me $20 million, I'm going to quit. Oh, I'm just going to go over and join a hedge fund. I mean, what, you know, all this, like, crap that goes on internally. While those are the larger numbers for the system, that's when you go back and wonder what Washington's actually thinking, because nowhere in the conversation that was going on about the House bill, for example, last week, did anybody mention the actual risk that's going on. You know, they talked about risk and stuff, but no one actually, like, quantified it at all. Not a single person in the room. So, you know, that's when it's a problem. So linking all that back to comp, it's like, yeah, you can pay high comp, high bonuses on the back of high trading profits that are high because you got so much more money and federal subsidies to go off and create them. And that's the problem. That's making the system not secure, and that's when, you know, we do care about the level of compensation. But simply coming in and saying, okay, well, that means I'm going to cap at $500,000, I'm going to cap at this, I'm going to cap at that, that doesn't change all of that additional risk that has been put into the system.
So, Nomi, let me compress the rest of this proposal, the bullet points, into the general area of regulation and then get your comment. The Barney Frank bill would establish a council of federal regulators to monitor the market. They would impose stricter standards and regulations on firms that are large enough or interconnected enough to put the entire economy at risk. They'd set up a $150 billion government fund financed by assessments on large financial firms to dissolve any large and highly complex financial companies, the too big to fail. They would merge the Office of the Comptroller, which supervises federally chartered banks, with the Office of Thrift Supervision, which supervises SNLs. And it would impose tighter restrictions on the largely unregulated derivatives market, require that any derivatives to be traded through clearinghouses where they could be monitored by the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And additionally, it would require hedge funds and private equity companies with more than $150 million in assets to be registered with the SEC and to disclose financial information. VCs, venture capitals, and small business investment companies would be exempt. This sounds to me, and in your book, you describe the way bankers and other financial operators have always been able to work around regulatory schemes. And attempts to address some of the most crucial areas, it seems already to have loopholes that you could drive a Citibank through.
Just the very last, you know, thing you said about, you know, you read about having the ability for hedge funds to have venture capital components that aren't under jurisdiction, even if they're big enough to be under jurisdiction. It's like, all right, well, I'm just going to call my hedge fund a VC.
Yeah.
Like, done. So it is true. There are so many loopholes for all that. So, you know, having a overseeing council where someone from the Treasury Department and the Fed and the SEC and everybody gets together and, like, goes through the banks and, like, decide where risk is and everything else. If, first of all, we have had agent. There are five different agencies who weren't able to do this in any really good measure, as we saw from the events of last year to begin with. But let's say that you take the best and the brightest from them and you stick them together in a council or another entity and say, all right, well, you guys really take a look at what's going on in the banks. This would only work if they knew what they were doing. If whoever was on that council actually understood the problems in what is, you know, so very apparent. I mean, just what I said before in terms of the stat of what, you know, all of a sudden the banking industry has made $120 billion out of wherever. If this council was to sit down and say, hey, wait a minute, how did you do that? Like, just how did you do that? And start from there and really dig in to find the answers, and then from that probably get more questions, and then start to, you know, contain some of the risk associated with that. That would be fine. But it's just so unclear that this is happening. That, you know, having an extra set of people trying to deal with it doesn't necessarily, enable them to find the problem and to contain it. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of the rest of the bill was about containing risk after it happens. You know, what do we do after or at the point at which a bank is about to fail? And what do we do if we see that risk is developing? Then do we have parameters to break up that bank and things like that, as opposed to preemptively saying, wait a minute, there's already risk in the system right now. We've had the largest trading fluctuation from year to year that we have ever had in the banking system. That should be a red flag right now. So what exactly is it we're waiting for?
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Nomi Prinz here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Her powerful new book is It Takes a Pillage, and I want to turn to that now. Explain your meaning of the oft-referenced term in the book, the Second Great Bank Depression.
Well, the first depression in the 30s was catalyzed by very similar things to what this current situation, the current financial situation, has been catalyzed by, which is banks and financial institutions, through the absence of being watched properly, through the ability to kind of mill together and use any sort of consumer deposits or consumer loans or anything that was real in order to borrow against and create new assets that were not so real but that could be marketed as being real and get investors really juiced up and have a whole lot of enthusiasm into them is exactly what happened leading up into the 1929 stock market crash, which was kind of the impetus or the more public impetus for the Great Depression. Now, before the 1929 crash, there was already a tremendous increase in foreclosures in homes in the country. There was a lot of real estate speculation and expansion that was promoted by Wall Street companies and created by other types of real estate companies, and these things called trusts that were created to basically house loans and assets and all sorts of things that were off-book, off-balance sheet. There wasn't really an SEC at the time, but that were basically very obtuse if anyone wanted to even look at them. And so when the markets crashed on the back of that and unleashed further aspect of a depression where we had, you know, 25% unemployment and breadlines and more home foreclosures and more issues with credit at the time and banks closing and everything else, that was a very financially catalyzed situation. It's no different right now. We had foreclosures increasing for a couple of years into the crisis period, or the bank component crisis period, last fall. We had credit problems. We had the speculative enthusiasm behind what became toxic assets, but this $14 trillion worth of assets that were created in the 5 years preceding the crisis that banks created out of loans and other things on the back of very little value, mm-hmm. that basically imploded, and that today still we don't know where they are or why all of a sudden they have value, because the loans beneath them have not gotten any better. In fact, yeah, they have deteriorated. So a lot of it's kind of based on smoke and mirror type of evaluation. You didn't have rating agencies back then. Now you do, so you have all these extra little rubber stamps on it. So when I say Second Great Bank Depression, it's an economic depression that has been catalyzed by bank activity, and that's no different from what happened during the First Great Depression. And the more that we don't contain this bank activity, and unfortunately, the more that we accept, or at least Washington accepts and a lot of the media accepts, that somehow all of the problems that we noted last year, all the failures, all the credit issues, all the toxic assets imploding, everything coming to a standstill, somehow magically been eradicated without any real structural reform of the banking system, is really setting ourselves up for a continuation of a bad period, even if they don't seem to realize it.
Well, and I do understand that the president, his Treasury Secretary, and the Fed chairman don't want to be talking us into a long economic decline. On the other hand, the rosy commentary and some of the projections and Geithner telling us that the recession is over, these strike me as attempts to build confidence, but we may end up remembering them as just the CON part of that, feeling conned by what they're trying to tell us right now.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, having confidence, if it is a con, is a danger. I mean, there was confidence in these assets to begin with, that, you know, the $14 trillion, that's, you know, more than the size of our national GDP, to begin with. And it was the illusion of their, you know, financial quality and how good they were and how people believed that. Of course, it wasn't the right, you know, sort of public people, but investor people believed that gave them the impetus to sell, for banks to sell them all over the place, whether it was to pension funds or to little, like, towns in Iceland or whatever it might be. So on the one hand, yeah, you don't want to talk down, especially if you're running the country or the Federal Reserve or the Treasury Department, you don't want to talk down anything that could be construed as positive for the
right.
economy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really dangerous not to notice that there are problems that have not been addressed. There are problems that are still developing, and the only thing that looks good on the surface is the profitability of some of these banks based on, you know, trading activities that I would dare anybody in the Fed or the Treasury to point to a set of assets that contribute to those trading profits and actually ask for the evaluations. And if those assets were to trade in today's market, would they get the price that banks are allowed to be pricing them at? Because I just don't think that's the fact. I think we're kind of lulling ourselves into this sense of, all right, well, everything's better. And without asking the strong questions, there's a way to say it. You know, if you're Obama, you could be like, you know what, rather than saying we're going to control excesses on Wall Street while at the same time record bonuses are being paid out, so no, President Obama, you're not containing anything. But rather than saying that, and he is acknowledging, of course, that jobs are a problem, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
But you know, and rather than throwing crumbs at small businesses and homeowners, which have always been on a voluntary basis with respect to banks, which is why nothing's happened, you know, actually said, look, you know what? We are still investigating what went on. Because no one, there has been no real answer to what went on. And if you,
oh,
if you
come on,
answer,
Nomi, wait a minute. Bernie Madoff is in jail for the rest of his life. What more do you want? You want more scalps?
He's a poster child of fraud. But the whole thing, if you ask what's gone on, you would get scared. And that's the problem. It's like they don't want to know. And I think that's dangerous. I could be wrong. We could go on this sort of frame of, you know, banks will continue to post profits and their assets will continue to be worth whatever they say they are and everything will be fine and they'll start to create new ones because everything's fine. And individuals will continue to not be able to refinance and small businesses will continue to close. And the unemployment number, which is, you know, went from 10.2 to 2%, which actually, if you include all the people that stopped looking for jobs and all the temporary jobs that stopped as of December 31st of this year, actually only went down a half of a percent, no,
right.
no more than that.
Yeah.
But still, you know, even if that were a trend and people were hiring and things were going up, you would still have to view what the banks are doing with skepticism. And I just don't see that coming out of Washington. So when I first wrote the book, it was more about the notion of, okay, what went on? Who got the money? Why did they get the money? How much did they get? What was it for? How did this build? And keeping track of it, which I've been doing on a monthly basis on my website. But now it's almost like, you know, all of that happened. And, you know, we have this bill passed in the House that, or this act passed in the House that's supposed to reform Wall Street. And it so doesn't that it's almost like, well, what does it really take for, you know, you guys to get this?
Mm-hmm. Nomi, I want to read from Chapter 2, a couple of paragraphs here. Here are some numbers for you. There were approximately $1.4 trillion worth of subprime loans outstanding in the U.S. at the end of 2007. By May 2009, there were foreclosure filings against approximately 5 million properties. If it was only the subprime market's fault, $1.4 trillion would have covered the entire problem. Right, you asked? Yet the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and the FDIC forked out more than $13 trillion to fix the, quote, housing correction. As Hank Paulson steadfastly referred to the second Great Bank Depression as late as November 20, 2008, when he was Treasury Secretary. With that money, the government could have bought up every residential mortgage in the country, about $12 trillion worth at the end of December 08, and still have had $1 trillion left over to buy homes for every single American who couldn't afford them and pay for health care to boot. And then you explain that there was much more to it than that, that Wall Street was engaged in a very dangerous practice called leverage, which you explain for sports fans. Let's say you have a hot tip that the Lakers are going to throw their game against the Knicks tonight. You call your bookie and tell them to put down $30,000 on the Knicks, even though you don't have anything close to that much on hand. Maybe you have about $1,000. You're a longtime client of the bookie, so he doesn't ask you to front more than the $1,000. You don't worry about how you'll pay him back because, hey, you can't lose. If you win bigger than you could have only using your own money, and if you lose, the bookie breaks your kneecaps. Then again, if you're Citigroup, you get $388 billion of government subsidies and your extremities remain intact. Now, I think you very succinctly described the nature of the problem and the risk of this unbridled leverage in less than a page there.
Well, it's actually not that, I mean, thank you, but it's not that complicated, and I think that was the point I was trying to bring out, that the way in which, you know, the story of how the problems happened and how the bailout happened and how everything's fine just completely missed the entire point of what banks do and how they operate, the leverage that they take, and the lack of, you know, the lack of responsibility that they have for when it falls apart. Not only do they have a lack of responsibility, they receive that extra money in order to go and do round two, which is what has happened, and yet we are congratulating them in the media and in Washington for somehow, you know, getting out of it. And it's like, it's really kind of troubling. And yes, if we had just paid back, and I wasn't advocating necessarily paying back everybody's mortgage, but the point is, in terms of the numbers, if we had done that, it would have been far cheaper. And it would actually have had the intended use, which was helping, you know, ease credit by helping, you know, renegotiate mortgages or whatever it might be with individuals. And instead what happened was the money went into the top level of banks, it went into trading, it went into bonuses, it went into acquisitions, and it did not go into helping individuals. Anyone who's trying to refinance a mortgage right now knows. And it didn't have to, because there was nothing mandatory about the money that was provided to the industry in any sort of way as to how they could use that money. There was no strings attached to not just TARP, but to any of the federal subsidies that were provided. And so it's no wonder the banks chose to, you know, hoard the capital and use it for kind of more selfish purposes than actually helping their customers stay solvent.
Naomi, one of the points you make in the book is that these institutions were permitted to create these very complex securitized investment products. And I don't pretend to know the depth of it all, but I have, I think, a pretty good layperson's overview of this. And when you start with derivatives, CDOs, ABSs, and then we have these insurance bets about whether the underlying investment will pay out or not, it really is a scheme that clearly was too complex even for the people who created them to dismantle and try to fix the so-called toxic parts. And it strikes me that we haven't addressed this. The Frank legislation takes a stab at it. But shouldn't we simply establish a law that you can't have a product that can't be explained by the people who are creating it? And if they can't do that, and if they can't create blueprints of what they're doing so that they can forensically go back and try to correct errors or this toxicity that develops, then they have no business creating and marketing those products.
Well, and they have no business exactly continuing to recreate them, which is what's happening now. And yeah, that would be a simple way to do that would be to say, all right, you can't recreate more than say 4 or 5 or whatever levels of an asset or whatever it might be. So you can't have this indefinite chain where assets link to other assets and so on down some chain, and then you can't sort of dismember it and figure out what you have in front of you. And just limiting the amount of times any one asset could get repackaged would be a start. And I know that wasn't part of the bill, and so what that leaves is the entire securitization, the whole mechanism that created the assets to begin with completely 100% intact, which just means it can happen again. And it's not only it can happen, it is happening again. One of the best places to get a job right now on Wall Street is in like distressed asset repackagings and selling and marketing. So basically,
now,
you understand
that,
little bit about what happened. You're in demand on Wall Street right now for a pretty high salary to sort of, you know, rebunch it up again and sort of go forward.
Now, isn't this kind of like hiring a bank robber to consult on security?
Yeah, it's pretty much that thing, because they know exactly what the security breaches are. And if you trust them, that's fine. And if you're not, you're screwed again, which is exactly what's happening right now. And it's not even so much, you know, I would have expected, we all, I think anyone following any sort of politics and sort of the power of the banking system would have expected a bill to be created that has a lot of loopholes and a lot of problems and a lot of commandeering to the banking sector itself. But it's sort of when you really note that it doesn't do very much beyond that. But it's so touted as reform that's the problem. You know, if there was a little more honesty, maybe even, if Nancy Pelosi wasn't sort of, so thrilled about this, not President Obama, et cetera, so thrilled about what's come forth, but said, you know what, we did what we could because, you'd have to admit it, but, you know, the banking sector was like just fighting us tooth and nail, and what we have is A, B, and C, but what we need to do is this. At least there'd be a little bit more honesty in the process and some acknowledgement or awareness that there are significant problems not being addressed and we should watch out for them, or the Senate should watch out for them, or whatever, that they exist, as opposed to, oh, we've just reformed it, everything's good right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just not true.
Naomi, I want to shift here. Have you ever spent much time in Italy?
I have spent some time in Italy.
Because I'm struck at the role the Medicis played during the development of the Roman Empire that ultimately became Italy. And I was there a few years ago, and I read a fascinating book about the Medicis ranging from the 15th up through the 18th century.
Uh-huh.
And basically, they ran what became Italy, because they were the financiers. They rented the armies when they were needed. They supplied a few popes, and some were bought, and some were members of the family.
Right.
And they built these beautiful palaces, the Uffizi Gallery and the Boboli Palace in Florence.
Right.
Basically, each time they had a big score. When they were returned to power during the ebb and flow of those centuries, then they'd build a new palace. And as you describe Goldman Sachs, and its role in the U.S. economy and really the global economy, it really struck me how much they are fulfilling the role that the Medicis did centuries ago.
Right. They continue to consolidate power and move on somewhere else and expand themselves. It's sort of like it sounds very similar.
Well, and these secular
and
governments are...
And with no counter.
Well, and that the popular governments are really just a front. Their work continues, and certainly, you know, they work with or co-opt government entities that are created, but the money rules.
No, it does. I mean, the money even, I think today Obama's having another meeting with the heads of Wall Street to ask them to, you know, continue to be responsible or something. And it's like... I don't know. It's sort of you've done all this. We've given you money. You're putting bonuses together. I keep telling you not to, but you're doing it anyway. So let's all get together and talk about it. And it's a very enabling situation.
Well, and you define in your book, I think, in a deep way, the culture of Wall Street, and that, you know, a chat with the president. It's nice. It's FaceTime. There's going to be a photo in the New York Times.
Yeah, and
but
there has been.
It will have no meaning on an ongoing basis whatsoever.
None. No, and you know, at any juncture during this year, there could have been more of a smackdown of the way in which banks operate, and there just simply wasn't, and there isn't, and there won't be.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Hank Paulson should be investigated? Do you think that he may have committed criminal offenses?
Well, I think he certainly stepped over any sort of conflict of interest line. I mean, there was even you know, that is a situation where he actually was supposed to kind of back off from his relationships with Wall Street, but that was put aside when we're in this, quote, emergency situation where, you know, he had no choice but to talk to all his old buddies, which he was doing anyway. And I think he had a solid, what they call in Wall Street, leadership position in manufacturing the bailout. And again, not just TARP, which is the public face of the bailout, but all of the trillions of dollars. He was very much a chief engineer. And not only from, you know, his position as Treasury Secretary and his relationship to Goldman and to other banks, but his sheer, that's who he is, that kind of a person. I mean, he did run the large firm. You know, Ben Bernanke and kind of Tim Geithner were, you know, absolutely involved in the construction of the bailout and everything else, and you know, maintaining the secrecy of many aspects of it. But, you know, Hank Paulson was built a career on basically telling people what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very likely he overstep things. It's unlikely he's going to be investigated because it will be said to have been part of what he did to, you know, save the country in a state of emergency. And look, banks are doing fine. It goes back to the whole we're doing fine now, so he did the right thing even though it was a hard choice. So if we're going with that story, the likelihood of an investigation into how that actually happened and how he really kept his you know, friends in power and his foes, you know, insolvent. I don't think that's going to. It should be looked at. Should be investigated. But I don't think it will be, as long as we believe the story that, or as long as Washington does that, that things are all fine right now and he did the right thing.
Now, is there some clause that I'm not familiar with, you know, in a banking law somewhere that says you're not allowed to loot the Treasury unless it's to save the banking system? I mean, you know, looting the Treasury is looting the Treasury, and that's what they've done to the tune of $13 trillion.
Right, right. And yeah, that's not the point of the Treasury. I mean, obviously, it's to maintain some sort of economic stability in the country, as is the Fed. But yeah, it's definitely not to just sort of give away capital and guarantees and cheap debt and all sorts of other perks to save the industry. When in particular, not that this seems to matter, you've lied about the entire reason for doing it, which was to help credit for the taxpayer public. You know, so like the rest of the taxpayers, not the bonus recipients.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
you know, that was the stated intent. So given that you haven't done that, I don't know how anyone can say TARP is a success or the bailout is a success, and no, absolutely shouldn't have looted the Treasury to do that. And having just the ability to do that should have, you know, been done by someone far more responsible to the taxpayers than to the banks.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you make of Senator Sanders' hold on the Bernanke reconfirmation to serve a second term as chairman of the Fed? I certainly applaud it. It's being framed in the corporate media as fringe characters, from Bernie Sanders to Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, yeah.
And I'm frankly disappointed that there aren't more mainstream characters who see the need, A, for transparency at the Fed, particularly after your devastating disclosures here, and secondly, that I think it would be healthy for us to find another Fed chairman and for Bernanke to go back to Princeton.
I'd also like to see the definition, by the way, change. But it's the same adoption of the story that things are better and that we've somehow come through the crisis in a positive way. And every part of that story, you know, Ben Bernanke just did, you know, a horrendous job of noticing any of the build out, any of the lists, any of all of that. And any of the subprime market problems, the loan problems, any of that. But let's say he even, okay, was not looking at information that was publicly available. He still, after that, basically approved a lot more mergers. He, you know, he created bigger banks out of the ones that were already too big to fail, and mm-hmm. everything else, which is the kind of things that Sanders and Paul and others are pointing out. But the mainstream is basically buying the story that he did what he had to do. You know, and this is, so those are the two things. If you believe he did what he had to do, then, yeah, he should stay there. If you believe there were other cheaper and better ways that didn't involve giving the banks everything and the public nothing, then you have to wonder why he would be reconfirmed.
Well, and I'd like to see Geithner resign, but there's no indication that the president will call for his resignation anytime soon.
Not going to happen.
Naomi, I want to focus here for a minute, and I'm cognizant of the time. I appreciate how much time you've given us today. There are two pieces of legislation that are really crucial to the problems that we faced. The Glass-Steagall Act, which came out of the 1930s, and nobody, you know, in our audience remembers who Glass or Steagall were. But many people know the face of Phil Graham, and he was the driver in the Graham-Leach-Bliley Financial Modernization Act of 1999, which Bill Clinton gleefully signed, and this really eviscerated the distinction between consumer banks and investment banks or bank holding companies in a way that permitted the kind of gambling to go on with the money of average people.
Right. And nothing has been done to redress putting that back together. And that's really where we are right now. We still have investment banks and insurance companies now melded into one thing. The Fed has been miserable at regulating that. I think this new council, if it gets created, will have similar problems, but, you know, perhaps someone in there will have the courage to ask real questions. I don't know. Those haven't been asked yet by the agencies that have been in existence. But I, you know, the fact that there was no, there's been some calls against from the same fringe people for a reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, which would have the effect of sort of breaking up the banks that are too big to fail, but in particular reducing the risk, reducing the amount of the revenue that they got from their trading and speculative activities, which is what the original Glass-Steagall Act did in 1933, which was repealed by the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999. And that would be a true reform of the banking system, but unfortunately that seems to, again, if you buy the story that everything's better now and we did everything is fine, then that's going to be a further just a further possibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, Naomi, I want to thank you again. I really appreciate what you've brought, which is a clear-headed analysis by a knowledgeable individual who understands the politics and the chemistry of the financial community in this country. And you have spared no one. You name names. You describe some of these ego-driven characters as they grabbed even more money on their way out the door. And I'm thinking of John Thane in particular at Merrill Lynch. And I, again, recommend the book to people because it is the best explanation of the mess that we are still dealing with and our failure to correct the underlying causes of these issues. It takes a pillage behind the bailouts, bonuses, and backroom deals from Washington to Wall Street. We've been talking with Naomi Prinz. Thank you, Naomi.
Thank you so much, Peter.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments are always welcome, pro or con. Drop me a note, peter@peterbcollins.com. Or should you disagree with your humble host, there's always full of it at peterbcollins.com. I'll get it.
Sit at my table and wage war on myself. Seems like it's all for nothing. I know the barricades, and I know the mortar in the wall breaks. I recognize the weapons, use them well.
Our music of the moment from R.E.M.
This is my
called World Leader Pretend.
Let me make it good.
Returning to our program right now, a very talented Mark Lisgard. He's based in Portland, and some people have routines that they use to cope with the stresses of daily life, with the setbacks that we encounter on a regular basis in our political system. And Mark writes poetry. And he has a new edition of his poems, his real-world-based poetry, called Babbling On in Babylon, Quest for the 11 Demandments. And we'll talk about those demandments as we move along here. Mark, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks, Peter B. Great to be there.
It's good to talk with you. And also, I do want to single you out and thank you for your support of the Peter B. Collins Show, because I've noticed that you've become a subscriber, a voluntary subscriber, and that sets a great example for everybody else listening.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a fan of yours for quite a few years since you're on broadcast radio, and followed your show online. And so it's important, I think, with the state of the economy and everything else, that we support progressives all over the place and do what we can to keep the democracy alive.
Well, I appreciate your support. Now, first of all, to the cover art, you put Barack Obama in Photoshop with Herman Munster.
It's putting a little bit of lipstick on Frankenstein, actually, as Sarah Palin might say.
Well, it strikes a chord because it does look like Herman Munster. And in my youth, I interviewed Fred Gwynn, who was the guy who played that part. And he was such a gentleman, a real prince. And he really reveled in that part. He enjoyed it quite a bit.
He was hilarious as Herman Munster, I must say.
Yeah. So, Mark, tell us about your daily habits. Are you the kind of person like me who's got a DVR or a TiVo, and you got Rachel and you got Keith and maybe a little Hardball, maybe a little Ed Schultz, and you watch it every day and then you say, what am I going to do about this?
Yeah, it's a way of just processing information, because it's coming at us in just, lightning fast, whether it be on the internet or broadcast or in the newspapers. So I use a variety of different sources to kind of pull together a creative response to a lot of the things that are troubling us. You know, everything from what I think is probably one of the biggest issues is campaign finance reform.
Yeah.
Because that starts with the money, and the money is what gets our elected leaders, so-called elected leaders, elected. And they're beholden to a lot of corporate interests, and that I think is really that's a big part of the problem so far. So,
well, you're certainly accurate, and we see it played out every day as the American people's wishes are ignored and corporate interests are embraced, as they kind of pat us on the head and say, "Oh, be a good progressive now. Sit down and shut up and be happy with the health care reform you got, not what you wanted."
Right, and this is something that even the founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson feared, is the entrenched beginning of corporate power with the British East Indian Tea Company and its ability to try to manipulate the colonists early on, and they saw that as a huge problem, and they they kind of set that in motion in terms of trying to get away from that entrenched power that could ultimately take hold of the government.
Mm-hmm. Now, Babbling On in Babylon is based on mostly the calendar year of 2008 and the campaign that was underway. So for some people, this will be a little bit of a blast into the recent past.
Right.
But if you've got a book there, I started on page 37 here with Republican Fascists. Which is performed to the tune of Camptown Races. Now, if I do the doo-dah, can you do the rest?
I will try.
All right, let's see how we get it. Go right ahead.
Here we go. Republican fascists sing their song.
Doo-dah, doo-dah.
John McCain loves the war real long.
Oh, dee-dah, doo-dah day.
Oh, he plots all night, and he smiles all day, with four more fascists in the right-wing fight.
Oh, dee-doo-dah-dah-buh. Dee-oh-da-doo-da-day. I see.
Mike Huckabee in his Bible belt.
Doo-da, doo-da.
Drops his drawers as the ice caps melt.
Oh, dee-doo-da-day.
Oh, the globe is hot, but his race is not. We'll see how he does when he loses his buzz.
Oh, dee-doo-da-day.
Giuliani and his mafia ties.
Doo-da, doo-da.
Sends full workers likewise, guys.
Oh, dee-doo-da-day.
He's running out of cash. Time to make a dash. They'll make you an offer you can't refuse.
Oh, dee-doo-da-day.
Thompson is tired and big.
Doo-da, doo-da. I didn't turn the page, sorry.
He needs a toupee or a really nice wig.
Oh, dee-doo-da-day.
To win, he needs a leap before he falls asleep. He sits at the ball as his numbers fall.
Oh, dee-doo-da-day.
Romney's mommy calls him Mitt.
Doo-da, doo-da.
Romney knows he's full of crap.
No, you can say shit. It's a podcast.
Okay, Romney knows he's full of shit.
Oh-dee-doo-da-day.
He flips until he flops. He knows not when to stop. He's a right winger. Give him the finger.
Oh-dee-doo-da-day.
There you go.
Well, people can tell we improvised that, but that was fun.
It is. I love doing parody with music, and that's kind of part of... I wrote another one called Thank You Very Much for the Banking Industry, kind of the tune of Thank You Very Much from The Scrooge.
Yeah, so, I've got that page turned down here. Let's see if I can put my finger on it. Let's go right to it. It was around November, right?
Or in December, I think. That was the time for kind of the Christmas.
Oh, here we are. Banksgiving, page 151.
Okay, here we go.
And what tune would this be?
Well, the Banksgiving is just a regular poem, but there's another one called Thank Us Very Much.
Oh, okay.
That's to the tune of Thank You Very Much that was done in A Christmas Carol by, I think it was Alistair Sims. I think that was the original British interpretation of the... here it is. It's on page 166.
Okay.
So it goes to the tune of Thank You Very Much. So, Thank Us Very Much, Thank Us Very Much, that's the nicest bailout ever given to AIG. We also got a thrill getting lots of bills for Goldman Sachs and other hacks from and so to Lehman Brothers and to Bear Stearns, Wells Fargo, Merrill Lynch, and PNC. We're really here to only ask your grandkids to pay the tax to pay us, or the sky will fall on thee. Pay us because we're corporate SOBs. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's the nicest paddle anyone's ever used on thee. The spanking will be long, so come on, sing along. You can borrow from China and those rich Saudis, and keep on borrowing from our parent England, and Spain and France, Japan and Germany. You really need to learn a lot. I've made off bet on credit swaps, so thank you very much for banking me. Thank you very, very, very much. There you go. Don't put me in a musical, please.
I don't think there's any risk.
Okay.
I know there are a lot of agents listening, but they'll probably say, well, he really knows how to write, and he knows how to rhyme.
Yeah. Other than that, we'll just call it a day.
Now, have you ever successfully sold one of your poems as a song?
I haven't, no, but I'm in the process of putting together a play I wrote called Banks for Nothing, and that I'm submitting it in the process of actually submitting it to the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Oh, great.
So we shall see, and that's kind of an interesting, it has kind of the Marx Brothers playing contemporary roles as bankers, so it has kind of the whole Marx Brothers parody satire to it mixed in with the current contemporary issue. So it should be a lot of fun.
If you need a little push, I know Ed Holmes, who is one of the leaders of the Mime Troupe, he has played the part of Dick Cheney on our program from time to time, and he's very convincing at it.
Oh, that's terrific. Very good. It's kind of good and bad, I guess.
Yeah. This one I thought was really fun. Page 47, Last Night I Took the R Out.
Okay.
And let me take a stab at this.
Yeah, you go for it this time.
Last night I took the R out to a West Want where we relaxed. Fwee Wange Republicans wanting a wound quabby about some wascally tax. The R said, this really is rather redundant, replaying R words without regrets. No recourse like the Bill of Rights, no radicals who like to rest. I said to R, we can go a wound and a wound with revolution in the air. Radical Republicans who want to whack Fwee with laissez-faire. Then R said, your rhythmic rant is really repulsive. I'm ready for the R ride. Wait a minute. I'm ready for the R back in ride. Then I said, do you really want me to one you back home? Then R said, I'm ready to go where I reside. Now, Barbara Walters should be formed to perform that on television live.
I would love to hear Barbara Walters recite that poem.
And right on the page before it, I like this one. Bush on Reconomics 101. You take this one.
Okay. This is on...
46.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Reconomics 101. This is if George Bush is actually teaching a class in economics, but we call it Reconomics. Hello, America, and welcome to my class on Reconomics. I'll learn you some fuzzy new math from AC Power Electronics. But first, let me pour you a drink. How about some gin and tonic? Y'all not know that freedom isn't free, which may seem a little ironic. But listen to what I have to say. I'm not just some simple moronic. We're making progress every day. You can hear the corporate harmonics. If folks just watch, work two or three jobs, low income wouldn't be so chronic. So keep on picking, and I'll keep grinning, like y'all hear in the Philharmonic. Fuzzy mass is just soft and warm. I reckon. I like reconomics.
Well, and he's now out giving motivational speeches?
Yeah, this is the strangest thing.
Who gets motivated by W?
I don't know. I think he should be, well, maybe he'll take over on Saturday Night Live like the Chris Farley down by the river in a trailer or something like that.
Oh, that's a good one.
I live in a car down by the river.
Oh, my. Now, yeah, it's very, very, very bizarre. Very bizarre.
Now, you've got a website at babblingoninbabylon.com, and if people can't spell Babylon, I'm not going to help them. They'll have to figure that out.
I think it's baby with lawn after it.
Okay. And you also sent me a recent piece, and this one I think is very powerful. And a lot of people know that Al Franken was an Air America talk show host. We know him as the comedian from Saturday Night Live and the guy who wrote the books about the lying Rush Limbaugh. And after the most protracted post-election struggle, he was narrowly elected as the senator from Minnesota. And he's kind of kept quiet. He cracked a joke at the Sotomayor confirmation hearing, and he's been doing his diligence, learning how it works, not offending the elders in the Senate, and he's actually been remarkably humor-free, at least in his public comments. But he took on a very important issue, which is that Halliburton and its subsidiary KBR had a lot of female contractors in Iraq. And one in particular was gruesomely raped repeatedly and then left in one of these containers, locked up, and just treated in a subhuman manner. And when she tried to, after returning to the United States, seek some compensation from her employer, she learned that the contract she had signed prevented her from suing them, even for criminal behavior by other people, presumably also working for Halliburton and or KBR. And so Franken has put an amendment to a bill that would hold these corporate defendants liable and really inoculate people from these kind of one-sided contracts that would limit their civil rights and criminal rights if they are wronged. And so you wrote a piece here, and I'd like you to read it because you name every one of the pro-rape Republicans who voted against Al Franken.
Yeah, in alphabetical order, so if everyone has their pen and pencil or pad and paper ready, this is called 30 Pro-Rape Republicans, and it's those Republicans that voted against this bill that Al Franken sponsored the amendment to that bill. So 30 pro-rape Republicans voted against Al Franken's amendment. The Defense Appropriations Bill holds liable corporate defendants. Defense contractors overseas are now stripped of their protection. No arbitration for rape cases to insulate corporate infection. Halliburton and KBR will no longer be those who receive defense contracts from the Treasury when they hide the rapes they leave. Alexander, Barrasso and Bond, Bunning, Burr and Brownback think women should be denied their rights. No courts, no public, no facts. Chambliss, Coburn, and Cochran, like cockroaches in the dark, vote against the civil rights of women with no regard. Corker, Kernan, Crapo, DeMint, Ensign, Enzi, and Graham side with their corporate masters who give them pork and ham. James Inhofe and John Isaacson, Mike Johans, and John Kyle also believe in big money they receive, voting no with vacant smiles. McCain, McConnell, and Risch vote nay, as does Robert Shelby and Sessions. Thune, Vitter, and Wicker boycott church when it comes to confessions. The misogynist party of Republicans should have Snow and Collins inquire, why do Republican men hate women? Shouldn't this party just die or retire?
Very powerful stuff. Nicely done, Mark. I'm very impressed by that. And most recently, in response to the action in the United States Senate, where the public option has been deep-sixed after it had been downsized and basically rendered meaningless and my fear was that it was actually designed to fail. Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece which is critical of the way this occurred. And this one's called The Senate Majority Book. Go ahead, Mark.
Actually, if you have that in front of you,
Okay. Go
ahead and read that one. And
I do. Okay, that's fine. There's a book with lots of hooks, U-turns, skid marks, and drama. The book has twists, the author insists, is need for signing Obama. It's no bestseller like Joseph Heller, but the book has plenty of clues, no public option for adoption, only a policy catch 22. You must buy from wise guys, your health care on an exchange, but we'll subsidize these wise guys. It's all part of the profit range. The book will contain a Medicare frame, but only if you're at least 55. And if you're younger, ignore the hunger for single payer when your health dives. The book's a mystery to repeat history, with profit leeches who smile with greed. Is it good news? This book review is really just another Harry Reid.
There you go.
Spelled H-A-R-I-R-Y.
R-E-A-D, right?
Yeah. Very good.
So, yeah, it's just something that, you know, and unfortunately, if Obama had been true in his when he was a state senator or U.S. senator about the single payer, and he brought that single payer to the presidential thing, then he could negotiate down from single payer to public option. But he started in a much weaker position.
Oh, the Democrats, including the White House, have been negotiating with themselves all along.
Yeah.
With the fiction that they could get some Republican support. But the real problems are in the Democratic caucus, including Joey Lieberman and Ben Nelson in particular. And we've got the two female senators, Landrieu from Louisiana and Lincoln from Arkansas, who are, you know, more committed to their corporate owners or masters than they are to the interests of their own public. I mean, Louisiana is a state that places last in virtually every category, whether it's education, health care, infant mortality. And for her to take a position that favors the oil companies that contribute to her campaigns over the people of her state who have been hit so hard in the post-Katrina period, it's just unconscionable.
Yeah, and I think it's when you start talking about labels in terms of, like, Republicans and Democrats, and there are differences, but we need to think in terms of corporatists versus the people, because they're corporatists who basically have bought the Republican Party and in some cases have even bought parts of the Democratic Party and those senators you just named. But, you know, we just need to think about it in terms of that dynamic in a way that kind of makes the people wake up. And if we could just get these blue-collar teabaggers on board with the progressive agenda and say, listen, you need health care as much as we do, and this is an issue that that you need just as badly. So it's just, you know, they've been fed Fox News and all that crap for so long. It's just hard to kind of combat years and years of indoctrination from the corporation.
Well, and you're right, and we're going to get now to your demandments that are in the final part of the book. And as we're speaking here, it's the 10th of December. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has not issued its ruling, but I fear that the Roberts Court will embrace corporate personhood over the rights of individuals and will expand the rights of corporations to participate in politics, which is a major setback. And I hope I'm wrong about this. I'd love to be able to praise the Roberts Court for its vision in rolling back corporate personhood. I just don't expect that to happen. So in your preamble to the demandments, your first demand is no more corporate personhood. And you correctly cite the 1886 case going back to a railroad battle with Santa Clara County, which is where San Jose, California is, that led to an interpretation that the corporation is an entity that has legal rights. And so I don't think we want to take time to read that, but I think it's an important preamble.
Right.
And then let's just tick off your demandments, because they really align with my agenda, Mark, and I'm glad to see it mirrored that way. You start off with thou shalt regulate big media.
Absolutely. We need to break up, you know, these huge media conglomerates that basically control about, you know, 80-85% of all the information that's disseminated. And, you know, this is where Sherman's Antitrust Act needs to come into play. And if Obama really was serious about bringing democracy back to this country, and just like Jimmy Carter did with AT&T, that he would start using antitrust and looking at these huge, powerful conglomerates that are dictating our policies.
Well, and I don't expect that because he is so aligned with the corporate interests, and he kept, not kept, but he appointed Tim Geithner, who was a part of the economic meltdown problem,
right,
to try to fix it. He's got Larry Summers there and all these Goldman Sachs alumni, and he's not going to, unfortunately, challenge these issues of corporatism because, well, he's a corporatist himself. That's very clear.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I mean, I think a lot of progressives knew that, but we had to vote for him anyway just because President McCain was unthinkable.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were really left without much of a choice. I mean, I personally wanted Dennis Kucinich, as I think many people did, but unfortunately he never got the due airtime that he needed to broadcast his message even louder and broader.
Well, and, you know, he was out watching UFOs with Shirley MacLaine. That's what the debates contributed to our knowledge of Dennis Kucinich. That was really sad.
Unbelievable.
Your second demandment, thou shalt reform campaign finance.
Yeah, and this is really the heart of it, because if we can take big money out of the election cycle, just if there was just a small tax, 2 to 5% or whatever, everyone pays for campaigns, and after the primary, then that money is used, and that's it. It's just a tax. There's no private money going into to support or, you know, take on special interests. That would certainly get people to get elected officials to respond to their constituents in a very meaningful way.
Yeah, we got to stop the bribery. It's that simple.
Exactly.
Your third demandment: deprivatize the vote. What do you want to, like, hand count on paper ballots?
Gee, what a novel idea.
I mean, who would have confidence in a system like that?
Exactly. I mean, only Canada and much of Europe and everyone else that actually believes in the integrity of the vote. And I really like when you have Brad Friedman on talking about those issues, because that is so important to get people informed about what's going on in local election precincts.
Absolutely, and if people don't know Brad Friedman, you go to bradblog.com. He is the election protection guy, and I first started talking with him back in 2005, and after the 2006 elections, my producer said, "So, we still want to have Brad on every week?" And I said, well, just as long as there are issues. You know, when we run out of issues, we'll slow them down to once a month or something. And of course, we never got there.
No.
So, fourth demandment, deprivatize the military.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just been such a huge problem, especially in the last 8 years with KBR and Halliburton and Blackwater, who's been one of the biggest defenders of using contracts. And like you mentioned before, KBR abusing their own female employees through ridiculous arbitration, fine line, you know, things in their contracts. I mean, we need to hold these companies accountable. And if we're going to have troops, let's just make them troops that are accountable to the U.S. Constitution, not private contractors that have no accountability at all.
Mm-hmm. Your fifth demandment, Medicare for all. And it does seem here in the last-minute skirmishes of the health insurance reform that they are going to open up Medicare to a small group of people over the age of 55,
yeah,
on some terms that appear to be not that attractive.
Yeah.
But it is a start, and, you know, given that Obama took single payer off the table from the get-go, this is the best way to cover the most people at the lowest cost.
Right, and the only problem is that it's taking an age group that's much higher risk for health issues, and then they're taking those off of the private insurers, who are happy, I'm sure, about that, since they don't have to deal with a lot of health claims that will be coming through. It'll be the government that'll be doing that.
Yeah,
which is good for people anyway. If they're over 55 and they need that assistance, that's great. But at the same time, it's still enriching the insurance industry.
Your sixth demandment: lift the caps on Social Security. And I would link this, Mark, to one other issue, and that is, we need to have the Social Security tax applied to the full income of every American. It would rescue the Social Security fund, and could also be used to help fund Medicare. And the other side of it is, we have to cap the mortgage deduction on luxury homes. And I live in California, where home costs are higher. But still, anybody who buys a house more than $2 million should not be getting a full write-off for the interest payments on the mortgage.
Yeah, that's just another issue of giving the very wealthy class that much more wealth and power in terms of, you know, it's not being fair to everyone else that relies on those taxes to help pay for the infrastructure. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Lifting the cap and then also increasing and taxing on full income, whether you're a millionaire or billionaire, and also luxury homes as well. I mean, that's really critical to if we really want to, you know, have a secure society.
Now, I'm going to jump through a couple of these quickly. Okay. You get no argument from me on the Employee Free Choice Act. I hope that Obama will eventually honor his commitment to that. Okay. Your eighth demandment, thou shalt nationalize renewable energy. Again, no argument. And here's a very important one, your ninth demandment. Congress declares war. And this is a constitutional issue that has been abused since Vietnam, and we need to return to simple constitutional rule, and that is Congress declares war, not just a unilateral action by the executive.
Yeah, exactly, and we're seeing the abuse. I mean, it's been going on for many, many years, but you know, it really needs to come down to Congress that makes that decision, because this is a decision that affects all of us, and not just one person has a say on what whether we go to war or not.
Mm-hmm. Your next 10th demandment is free education through college, and it's sad here in California where we had led the public education, higher education system. The Schwarzenegger's refusal to raise taxes has just cost families of students in the California system more than a 200% increase in the last 5 or 6 years, and those escalations will continue. They have abandoned the commitment to investing in future generations through higher education.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You know, it's really shooting ourselves in the foot. And, you know, when you think about the ownership of many of our resources, they're foreign owners that are actually own our country now in a lot of ways. And it really has put us in a hole. And if we're not educating our own citizens, you know, what does that say about us? I mean, that's about as anti-American as it gets, I think.
And I'll read the final demandment, number 11, end free trade and higher tariffs. It should be a patriot's duty to support manufacturing's base, to keep well-paid jobs right here, not in a foreign sweatshop place. From the founding of this nation to the eve of World War I, tariffs were the largest source of our government's income. Then the income tax was added, funding plans after the war. Americans bound in community saw manufacturing soar. Tariffs help protect good jobs from outsourcing overseas. Raising the duty of foreign products allows blue collars to breathe. During the 50s, Ike had it right. Higher tariffs and corporate tax were a country of proud citizens, not consumers of tawdry crap. This demand is long overdue to bring America back to the top. Let's export those neocons to Malaysia's cheap sweatshops.
There you go.
I have a whole list of people we could put on the first manifest for that,
there we go.
That export.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, it's great to talk with you. You are very well informed, very progressive in your politics, and you rhyme like a son of a bitch.
Thanks, Peter B. That's a great compliment coming from you. I appreciate it.
Again, the website, Babbling On in Babylon, same title of the book, Babbling On in Babylon. We've been talking with Mark Lisgard. Happy holidays, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments? Send them to me, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.